News Talk Breakfast.
In association with AIR. Do anything, anywhere with high-speed 4G mobile data coverage across 96% of the population.
This is News Talk.
Now, I'm delighted to be joined in studio this Sunday morning by Lynn Ruane, independent senator, former president of Trinity College Dublin and author of People Like Me. Lynn, thanks for coming in to us. It's lovely to see you.
Good morning. Thank you.
Lynn, we might start with something that you were involved with earlier this week. I saw a lot of this online, on Twitter and social media during the week. This new digital animation series, which was launched to try and help adolescents and young people, I suppose, express and deal with some of the mental health issues that they face. Tell me a little bit about the initiative.
So it's part of a wider study, and there's a few people involved. There's the RCSI and Spunnu and the IADT, the students there, the animation students. So I was asked to launch it, but when I actually sat down to watch the animations before I spoke, they're just really simple, understandable. And I think what they all kind of map out a few different areas, whether it be bullying, whether it be depression, anxiety. But I think we've, over the last few years, we really talk in those real broad terms about what the animations do is they kind of give you a little story as to what that actually means, you know. So feeling left out, feeling lonely, not feeling like other people, feeling like if somebody doesn't contact you for a few days that you must have done something wrong, and how them anxieties manifest. So it was really specific in terms of what actually does it mean? What does anxiety mean? Because I think sometimes
I noticed that about it, actually, because it wasn't that broad. It was quite specific. And I think we often talk about young people and say even the WhatsApp culture, like, you know, you might send a WhatsApp message now into a group message and nobody comes back to you. And like years ago, like people would reply to your text, whereas we're all now a bit like, you know, oh, I can do that later on. And that can be really hurtful depending on your frame of mind at that point. But it was quite specific, and loneliness and isolation are big things for
and
young
people. I think for loneliness and isolation, we don't tend to talk about it when we talk about young people. We talk about it when we talk about older people and isolation. I think isolation is huge. There's so much going on in the world right now, and there's so many forms of communication, it's hard to keep up with them. But I think isolation, loneliness, depression, anxiety have always been there, and I think we've framed them differently and they've manifested themselves differently throughout different generations. Like if I look at some of the older people in my life, they might say, oh, I had a nervous breakdown in my 30s, and they could be in their 70s, or I had a bad nervous system, you know,
suffered from my nerves. Yeah, like you hear people say that.
Yeah, so I think we've always had these issues. They just look different. We've communicated them differently, and how we talked about them was relative to the generation that we were living in. So I just think now we have a little bit more understanding of how to actually get into what does that actually mean. I mean, I've had anxiety manifest itself in me in many different ways. When I was younger, I resorted to very negative behaviour, drug use, self-medication, then anger manifested. And I think now in the last few years, the anger has subsided. I'm in a bit of a safer space in my life. So now I feel the anxiety part of it, you know, the physical sensation in the body without the external negative behaviours. So I haven't to work through that. And I think that's, for me, why it's important to get involved in mental health campaigns, is that sometimes I think when we tell someone, listen, you just need to talk, I think it's a bit of a false kind of idea to give to someone that, because there's so much more in it than just talking. The talking is the bit where you expose yourself and you expose some vulnerabilities.
But then what do you do?
And then the healing happens.
Then, you know,
exactly. So it's about, so I like to kind of point out that my mental health journey has looked different at different stages. And as I've talked more and exposed them vulnerabilities, as scary as they are, I've tried to overpower the negative narrative in my head that tells me not to talk. And when I talk and when I engage with positive activities, even when I'm feeling at my worst, it actually allows me to learn how to respond to my anxiety or mental health issues in a different way than I would have when I was younger. So I think creating that culture of openness is scary, but it's I think it's crucial for people to be able to move through and be supported.
Yeah, I might just ask you what your take on, you know, I did the Darkness Into Light yesterday morning before the show, and I was talking on News Talk Breakfast yesterday about how kind of annoys me a little bit that in this country we're very quick to ask people to open up and to talk about things if they're not feeling well. And we tell people that that is what they should do. And we have all these feel-good campaigns and there's a lot of money spent on them. And then people take that advice and they say, OK, I'm not feeling well, I'm going to go and look for help. Then there's no help
for them.
Nothing
there.
Yeah. Like, that really annoys me, because I think, like you said, the biggest thing that somebody, like the biggest journey someone will be on will be up to the side of the cliff where they say, okay, I need to admit that I need help. And then for them, that's like jumping off the cliff. Yeah. And if there's no one there to catch them then when they decide that they have the courage to do that, I can't imagine the damage that that might do.
It does. I mean, I try not to speak too personally, but I mean, I've intervened in many suicide attempts, and it has been very, very difficult, because when they get to the point where they're saying, I've been asking for help, nobody noticed, like, it doesn't be just one single thing. It can be, you know, there can be a pattern for weeks where somebody is looking for help, asking for help, and then they get to that point. I mean, I've had to ring ambulances to doors because I couldn't get to a person quick enough. And then you get there and you get the ambulance and you intervene, and then you're like, well, what the hell do I do now? And then you're told there's a waiting list, or then, like, it depends on your age. If you were younger,
or
trying to get
through
Lucina,
have you the money? Have you 10,000?
But you see,
you know,
and for the most people that I in my community are not going to have that type of money. I mean, for you to even go into St. Pat's, if you didn't have health insurance, and not that hospitalisation is needed for everyone, I'm just giving that as one example, it's 27,000 up front. You know, so I mean, where you are in terms of your socioeconomic status is really going to determine how quick you can get help.
You mentioned there, Lynn, when you were younger, and I've read your book, People Like Me, so I know you gave your parents a little bit of a tough time when you were younger. Lots of people will be familiar with your story, but you might just remind people who aren't familiar with it. I suppose you had an unusual journey from childhood in Kilnarden in Talla to ending up as president of the Students' Union in Trinity. Maybe give us a little synopsis of it, if you can.
Yeah, well, I suppose, like, I mean, I didn't realise I was any different to any other kid growing up. But when I look back now, I think I always felt I had to work harder than everyone else to be liked. I wanted to be liked. I had this need. I had this massive fear of rejection. And I realise now how much that shaped my behaviour, even before the big events that happened in my life. You know, so when I witnessed a pal die on a road in a traffic accident, that had a massive impact on me. And then I also had some family stuff, found out my dad was older than he was, and that took a big chunk out of me. And I thought those were the real two defining moments in my life that really affected my mental health. But actually, when I look further back at who I was actually always maybe really felt that I was different, and I wasn't. After Jenny died and after a few different events, I just kind of emerged and embraced drug use and just altering my mind, not wanting to feel, just wanting to be temporarily taken out of existence. I never felt that I wanted to die, but I definitely wanted to be temporarily removed. Opted out of life, when I could. The fact that I would engage in such risky behaviour to take drugs, not just for fun and recreationally, but to the point where you would be knocked out, you know. And when somebody engages in risky behaviour like that, now I know it's because they actually feel like they've nothing to lose. So if you're willing to risk your life in that way, even if you're saying that you're not, it's not that you have suicide ideation, you're not, but you are taking massive risks. And I think sometimes when growing up in an area that has a lot of mental health issues, a lot of poverty, a lot of hardship, we take huge risks with our lives. And social class is killing us, and social class is manifesting our mental health in various different ways.
You talk a bit in the book as well about becoming pregnant at 15 and your daughter, and I know you don't really like saying that, you know, she sort of saved you, but in a way she did, or in a way she was the catalyst for why you got your act together.
Yeah, like, I think again, because I have obviously being a teenage mother is really, really difficult, and you know, I muttered through years of my own bad mental health, like my own mental health not being great because of everything I've experienced, but I did the best that I could. But what I'm an addict in every area of my life. I have tinkered around the edges of addiction, and I still do now. Like, I'm 90 days today alcohol free, and that's not because I had become an alcoholic, but because I could recognise behaviours.
Oh, really?
Yes,
okay.
Because I recognise when I start to lean on something, because I want to shut my
brain
off.
Do you think that's an addictive personality?
I don't know whether it's a personality thing. I just think I've always been trying to fill a hole in my soul, you know. So if my brain starts to race, because I suffer with anxiety, but also I suffer with over-analysis and overthinking. So I try and look for ways to stop that. So if I see that that's happening, I step away from it. So I do things in extremes. It's how I've lived my life.
So you noticed that you just felt you were getting to a dangerous point with alcohol. So you said, that's it. Pull it out altogether.
Yeah. Now, that doesn't mean I won't drink ever again. It just notices that I must be going through a very stressful period.
Or you want to prove to yourself that you can go without it in a way.
But yeah, well, there's a few different reasons. I wouldn't have been drinking every day or anything, but I do notice when I'm using it to shut my brain off.
Okay.
And that's a scary road for me because I've always been so close to tipping over the edge into addiction, you know, and I have kind of engaged in chaotic drug use when I'm younger. So it just makes me feel a little bit more aware of why I'm picking this drink up. Why am I having this glass of wine? That's what happened with Mudrin. So what I do is, Joran is not a substance, but what I had was something else to love and focus on and try be good at. So I felt like I was failing at life, and maybe this I could might not fail at. Maybe if she succeeds in life, I have succeeded, which is not good for her, because then she
you put a lot of pressure.
The pressure I put on her, that was unhealthy, you know. But I was only young, but in my head I was like, if I can, you know, raise this amazing, beautiful, and she's an amazing kid. She's an amazing young woman.
She's knocking it out of the park.
She is,
now,
but she's doing that on her own. I mean, I'm no actress and I'm not an artist, and I'm, you know, everything that she has is completely separate to who I am, you know. And she's absolutely amazing, and she's had a lot of positive influences around her. But getting pregnant, I think, was, and moving out of addiction and trying to get into education, was another part of my character where I need to succeed at motherhood, because at least that's something then I've managed to do well. That's what saved me.
And that's what pushed you, probably. Let's talk about Trinity for a minute. So you managed to get into Trinity through the Access programme. Yes. How did you find it? It's been in the news. Trinity's been in the news this week. We'll come on and talk about that. But I'm interested to hear your experience in Trinity.
Yeah.
Did you enjoy your time there?
I did. I absolutely loved my time in Trinity. And I still love Trinity. And I love... I launched their campaign, their philanthropy campaign, 2 weeks ago, and it was absolutely amazing to be part of that. Trinity is a beautiful place. We need to work really hard to increase the diversity that exists within Trinity, and to allow all those lived experiences and different lives be able to learn side by side. And you know, Trinity is, you know, everything that I am as a Tala woman matched with the education and articulation that Trinity has gave me. I kind of feel that they're the two parts of me,
okay,
you know,
connected.
And
to it.
Yeah, and so my experience was really positive. Not everybody has a great experience of education, but I have.
It was in the news earlier this week. There was some talk about Trinity. It was to do with this controversy over an aspect of their graduation ceremony, to do with the fact that graduates get called up in descending order of academic achievement. So if you get a first, you get called up first. If you get a 2-2, you're near the end. Some calls for it to be done away with. What do you think?
I can't even remember when I was asked that question about that, and it ended up in the paper this week, and I've got a bit of stick about it. I think somebody came on to call me a snowflake, and here I am. Why?
I don't think you're a snowflake.
Not
let's
at all.
Just say that.
And I'm already sure you're a snowflake. But I was asked a question about this. And I've had friends that have written and asked for their, pretended that they're going away on holidays when the graduation is coming up. They don't want to go. And that is a reality. And I think we do need to acknowledge, you know, outstanding academic achievement. And I think that that's okay. I don't think see anything wrong with that. But they do it in descending order. I think I was the second last. I got a 2-2 in my degree. I considered not going. And I considered not going as well. And I put so much hard work in my degree. And then I was working at the same time as in the Shannon, rearing kids. And I had to measure that up and go, well, of course you got a 2-2.
Yeah, and it's still your degree.
It's still your degree, but you've had all these other things going on. So I had to really battle past that. But some people don't, and some people feel embarrassed. And
should they change it, do you think?
I think maybe acknowledging top academic achievement is fine. But I think from, like, unless you've got, like, you know, unless you have 5 to 10, like, the top marks,
and then everyone else,
and then
just
everybody
do
else. I think so. I mean, I don't necessarily think that Trinity would necessarily be against that. I think sometimes tradition has been there that long that people don't
sometimes
challenge
it.
It's just the way it is. Yeah, you know. And for me, like, it's not something I'll be going to campaigning for. Like, I just asked a question and I answered it, you know. But I think Trinity would be open to looking at how they do ceremonies, because we are such a diverse community now with so much responsibilities going into do our education, and being able to acknowledge the work that people do outside of the college is within the college in terms of outside
important.
Of the classroom is as important.
You mentioned campaigning there, and you were at the front and centre this time last year. We were running up very closely to repeal of the Eighth Amendment. And when you look back on that now, this time last year, what are your feelings?
I found a video on my Facebook memories before the referendum was even called of me and my daughter standing on the stage at the fundraiser in
the Olympia.
And I just, the tears, because when I was listening back, I didn't. And I listened to mine and my daughter's contribution, and we were saying how very little women in our community are talking openly. But yet they came out and forced to vote on it. You know what I mean? So I felt like I got a new renowned respect and insight into who my community really, really are, you know, because I had huge fears at the time that we weren't talking about it in working class communities. But obviously people were thinking about it. They just weren't talking about it. And I just look back now and just feel so proud of where we've come. Yeah,
absolutely. Now, finally, you, as you said, you're in the Shannon there. You were elected in 2016. You're an independent senator. We're in election mode at the minute, local and European elections, and we'll have a general election before too long. What are your political ambitions?
I don't have any right now other than what I'm doing. I kind of measure what I do in work, whether it was when I worked in addiction or homelessness, about how effective I actually am. And I always move on from a position when I feel I'm not having any effect. I have a number of pieces of legislation that I want to bring through to Shannon. I've tabled so many amendments and I've won a lot of amendments. And I think if you actually statistically measured what the Shannon has achieved this time round and the civil engagement group that's led up by Alice Mary Higgins in the Shannon, we've achieved so much more than many of the even smaller parties or independents in the Dáil, because of the arithmetic is a little bit different. So I'm quite happy if the numbers stay in my favour. I'm not really interested in the Dáil. I don't really want to be grounded into local politics kind of driving my daily agenda. Not right now anyway. I'm really interested in national conversations around education and around drug decriminalisation and mental health and spent convictions. And I don't know if I would get as much time in the Dáil, because you'd have so much constituency work to do. Would I actually get time to drive those campaigns? And at heart, I'm a community worker and I'm a campaigner. So I like to be able to merge the political world with who I am as a community worker, and I feel I can do that in the Shannon right now. So for the first time in my life, I'm not kind of planning what's next.
Okay,
I'm kind
you're
of
just doing what's
doing
now.
What I'm doing. Yeah.
Living
yeah.
in the moment.
That's it.
And life is good. And you've your
is.
Second daughter as well.
She
all
is.
Good with her.
Yeah,
she is a little actress too.
She well, yeah, but she's not as, she doesn't really like the acting as
does
much.
She?
But she does it. She does it for the cash. She's like the one she's like the new generation that's all about how much money can I make and how quick can I make it. So we've still a bit of work to do on her in terms of like socialism and stuff.
Well, keep going with that. You're doing a fantastic job in all aspects, motherhood and everything else.
Thank you.
It was an absolute pleasure to have you in on News Talk Breakfast. Lynn Ruane, thanks for being my guest this morning.